Now, in a certain sense, and it's a very paradoxical feeling, but I intuit that we may have the opportunity to send soldiers in and free our boys. However, that entails a certain danger to the soldiers. What would you say is sort of like the classical case in modern Jewish history of the State of Israel in which that happened? What? Oh, Malod, Entebbe. I was thinking of Entebbe because what do you say?
Nachshon
Waxman, right? Also, and the breakthrough was really halakhically was Entebbe, because if you know the history of it, at that time, the rabbin's government actually turned to the chief rabbi, the Sephardic chief rabbi of Adil Yosef Zichron Levrach, and asked him, would there be a halakhic justification, and would it be permissible to send soldiers in, putting their lives on the line in order to save hostages from the terrorists? The threat to human life here is immediate and it's urgent, and these terrorists, they're shofkei damim, and there's no question about it. On the other hand, there's no question that by sending in soldiers, you're endangering their lives. So let's talk for a moment about the general question: do I put my life into danger in order to save your life? Meaning, your life is in a vadai situation. If nothing is done, you'll perish. My life, by exposing myself to danger, will be in a suffek pikuach nefesh, but not a vadai. So there's a famous Kesef Mishnah on this question from Rav Yosef Karo, the Moran HaMechaber, in which he says that since your situation to save someone is only a suffek, his situation is a vadai. We have an overriding principle in halacha called suffek ain suffek motzim midei vadai, which means that vadai, something that's certain, is always stronger than something that's a suffek. So you go in there, expose yourself to danger for the sake of hatzalat nefesh in order to save someone else's life. And the Chavos Yair, whose name was Bachrach, he was a German Jew, lived about 4 centuries ago. He writes the following. If you take a look on your page 2, it's about, 2/3 the way down in the page. And you'll see where it says, Shut Chavos Yair, in which he quotes the Kesef Mishnah from Perek Aleph of Hilchos Rotzeach. And there the Kesef Mishnah writes, B'shem HaYushalmi, we don't know where this Yushalmi is, by the way. And what's the next word? Because that's the key word here. Shemeh. Chuyav, do you see that? Shemechuyav lichnos or likanes lisafek nefesh, lisafek nafsho, meaning to put his own nefesh into a suffix situation, lahatzil nefesh chavero. Okay, now this lechora is a very difficult position because I have to put my life into danger for 3 averos, not for anything else. And hatzolos nefashos is a great mitzvah to save someone else's life, but it doesn't mean that I have to endanger my life. For example, let's say in the case of Rabbi Akiva, where 2 are going through the desert, right? That's the Gemara Bava Metzia that you'll see here on the same page. Shnayim shalim mahalchim baderech, and one of them has a kiton shalmayim. If they split the water, they'll both perish. And one of them, let's call him Reuven, has the Kiton Shalmayim. Is he obligated to share the water with his friend Shimon? Now, Shimon is going to perish if he doesn't do so. And here's where Rabbi Akiva formulates the very famous principle of Chayecha Kodmin L'Chayecha Vercha, that you don't have to expose yourself to danger in order to save someone else's life. And that's called v'cheyachicha imach. Imach means, do whatever you can to save him. Obviously, you go to all ends of the world. The Gemara says if you can't jump into the water, then hire someone else, to jump into the water, professionals. And by the way, this situation where one person exposes himself to danger to save someone else is very common in life-saving. Is anybody here in the room who has life-saving? Has the degree you do? So I don't know if you've heard of occasions, there was a famous situation that came up in Florida off the coast of Miami not that long ago, in which somebody was drowning, the lifesaver went in and he drowned. So what happened was, this woman, she was a famous Rebbetzin, her husband was a Rebbe in a place called Hafter. I don't know if any of you have heard that's out in the island. and she perished, the lifeguard perished, and then someone else jumped in as well and he perished. Three people died because of an undercurrent. Okay, so it's, you know, you can have life saving, but it's very, very dangerous. In any event, getting back to the Gemara Bava Metzia, Rabbi Akiva says, I don't have to give up my life for the sake of your life. Whether I can do that, in a shall we call it behitnadvut, you know, voluntarily or not, that's a different issue, but I'm certainly not obligated. And therefore, to send soldiers in and expose themselves to danger in order to save other Jews from imminent danger, l'chora would be prohibited.
Wasn't the case of
Rabbi Akiva Badai? Oh, excellent. So that's the Chavos Yoreh. What you say is the Chavos Yoreh. The Chavos Yoreh says the following. He says, if you look in the Gemara, it seems Dafka Hasam, what was the case that the Gemara says? The Gemara formulates it, Im Yishtu Shneam Yamusu. If they split the water, they'll both die. Vadai. It would seem that if Reuven were to give up his water, he, Reuven, would die. In the act of saving someone, there's no question that he would die. So that Rabbi Akiva says Chayecha Kodmi. Masha'enke B'Safek Yeshlom, and the Chavos Yoreh suggests that if Reuven would only have to endanger his life, then even Rabbi Akiva would say Yishtu Shteyam. That means if Reuven may or may not survive by splitting the water, then he would be obligated to split the water, and that's the, let's say, the Bavli and the Shas Bavli. That's the basis for the same conclusion that Kesef Mishnah comes from the Yerushalmi. So it's fascinating now that we have two poskim who are saying that one has to expose himself to danger in a suffering situation in order to save someone else from a vadai, from definitely perishing. And one could argue, therefore, that sending in Israeli soldiers in order to save hostages would be like exposing them to a suffering in order to save someone from a vadai. The problem is that this opinion of the Kesef Mishnah, based on a phantom Yerushalmi, you don't know where it is, and the support that's brought by the Chavos Yoreh is all a matter of, how shall I say, tremendous controversy. And I mentioned to you that during the Entebbe incident, this question was presented to Rav Ovadia Yosef, and he has a 40-page tshuva. In the first 39 pages, he says, you cannot expose someone to danger for the sake of Hatzolos and the Foshas, to save someone else from definite danger. Okay? Rav Chaim Heller addresses this Chavos Yoreh. How many of you heard of Rav Chaim Heller? None of you? Rav Chaim Heller. He wrote a Sefer HaMitzvos of the Rambam with footnotes. I mean, he did many other things too. He was a tremendous scholar. My Rebbe Rabbi Soloveitchik held Rav Chaim Heller to be his Rebbe. I mean, he was such a genius. And Rav Chaim Heller, in his footnotes, they say that the day that this book was published, the Chafetz Chaim put on his Big Day Shabbos. And they asked him, why are you wearing Big Day Shabbos? He says, Haint is Yontif. Why is it Yontif? Because Rav Chaim Heller's Sefer HaMitzvos came out. So he says the following, Ein zu raya, there's no proof. Dahai denok et shneihem yom musu vadai. Why did the Gemara formulate the case of the Shnayim Shari Mahalchim Baderech as a case of vadai, where they would both perish? Rabusa de Ben Ptura Noket. Ben Ptura says he split the water. The Chiddush of Ben Ptura is, even though they're definitely going to perish, nevertheless he split the water. Afilu Bezeh, even in such a case, Ka'amar Ben Ptura Yishtu Shneem V'Al Yira Echad Mehem V'Bisa V'Mas Soso Shal Chavero. But Enechinami, it could be a coin to Rabbi Akiva, even in case of Safek Chayecha Kodmin L'Chaye Chavero. Well, Rabos, I want to tell you this. At the end of the tshuva of Rav Ovadia Yosef, in the last page of 40 pages, he says that terrorism comes under a different halacha. That even though you don't force a person and you don't obligate a person to expose himself to danger to save someone else, but if we're battling against terrorism, he says a whole new set of halachas kick in. And those are the halachas of what?
Mitzvah Milcham.
We are in a war situation against terrorism. Now, that premise that Rav Ovadia Yosef works on, in which he told the Rabin government at that time to justify in going through Pulat and Tevi, that premise is questionable, and I'll tell you why. Milchama usually applies when the following two conditions are met. First of all, it's a nation that's going out and declaring war against the Jewish nation. And secondly, the Melech, the king, makes the final decision to send the soldiers out to battle. I'm not sure if either of those conditions are met by terrorism.
It's Hamas, they're part of the government.
Oh, excellent. I was hoping somebody would say that. That it could be that today, Arab terrorism really has the halakha of milchama, because we're not fighting against individual terrorists. You know, like you have a rebellion sometimes in a country, and you have to kill the rebels. So I'm not sure if the laws of milchama will kick in just because there's a group of rebellious individuals who want to take over the government. You know, you have to snub them out, but that doesn't mean you have to expose people to danger. On the other hand, in this case of terrorism, insofar as they represent a kind of quasi-government, again, it's not a government that we recognize, but maybe we'd have halach of a nation. You know, the nation of Palestine, whatever that is, has declared war against us, and the terrorists are their soldiers. That might incur a mitzvah milcham. But what about the issue of a melech? So what I want to share with you, if you have on page 3, this is a tshuva in Mishpat Cohen. Who authored Mishpat Cohen, everybody knows? Rav Kook, right? This is the first chief rabbi of Palestine, if we mention Palestine. And he is...
Not the same.
Right? He's addressing the issue of the Chashmonaim and whether or not they were justified in going out to battle against Syria, because keep in mind that Syria would require a melech, and it's very questionable whether the Chashmonaim could usurp the Malchus, because they came from Shevet Kohuna. And if you remember, Yaakov Avinu says at the end of Vayichi Lo Yosur Shevet Mi Yehuda, that the Malchus belongs to Shevet Yehuda. Chashmonaim came from Shevet Levi, from Shevet Kohanim. They had no right to take the Malchus. And there's a whole controversy about this, about the status or the permissibility of the Chashmonaim doing what they did and fighting the battles that they fought. In any event,
the Ten Shoftim had their own Malchus for a long time also.
Oh, what? Yeah, years. Who was the first Melch of Israel?
Shaul
was not from Shevet Yehuda. Shaul was the Amini. So in that sense, what was the status of Shaul? And Rav Kook goes even beyond that. He wants to address the issue of what was the status of Shoftim in general. And the Nafka Mina is where they can go out to battle. But I want to tell you something. Going out to battle is a very far-reaching decision. But even forgetting about Melchama, there's a halach. If you turn back to page 2 for a moment, you'll see the Rambam in Hilchas Melachim, who says the following, that in order to put a person to death, this is the third source up from the bottom of page 2, you must have a raya brura, you have to have clear-cut evidence. In halacha, clear-cut evidence means nothing less than 2 witnesses. If you can't put someone to death, even if there were 2 witnesses for the crime, unless there was a hasra, there was a warning. What if there was only 1 aid? Or what if a person killed b'shogeg? And now he says, the Rambam, something very far-reaching. He says, Yesh lemelech reshus lahargo uletaken olam. There's a new concept called tikkun olam, which means that the government, the king, representing the people, has a right to go to all extremes for tikkun olam in order to establish what has to be established. You know, if the evidence is clear, but we're missing a little bit of a piece of the puzzle, because the halachas of evidence are very, very technical and very demanding, nevertheless, the melech could decide to have someone put to death. That's a very, very great power to a king. And I was thinking then, if, let's say, the Israelis would decide to send in soldiers with a kal vachomer, I would say, if they represent Malchus, again, we'll come back to that point in just a minute, but if you'll grant me for just one moment that the state of Israel and its government has the status of a melech, then it could be with a kal vachomer. I mean, if they're allowed to put someone to death if they tikkun olam, perhaps we're allowed to suggest that they could certainly expose someone to a danger, in this case chayalim, who going in on a pula in order to save hostages, put their lives into danger. But the problem is that the next Rambam I want to show you in the same chapter, the Rambam says that in order to set up a melech, you need bezdin shel shivim zakenim. Now, do we have today a Bezdin of Shivim Zakenim?
They're trying,
you know. And the truth be told, even back in the time of Beit Yosef, 5 centuries ago in Tzfat, they tried to set up a Bezdin with Smuchim and so forth and so on. But trust me on this, Rabbi Osai, halacha l'maisa, we don't have a Bezdin of Shivim V'yachad. Not yet, hopefully soon. In fact, The Bittul HaSanhedrin took place even before the Churban HaBayis by 40 years. So we're going back in a time machine if we want to talk about Sanhedrin. The Rambam says it's not even enough to have a Sanhedrin to appoint a Melech. In addition, the Rambam has another condition. You need what? Alpi Navi. And last I checked, you know, we don't have too many Nevuim. Although Chazal say that Nevuah was given over to Shotim, so that we have. But none in Glide, but okay.
In any event, users of Glide.
Yeah, right. That's it. Yeah, those who Mishim and Atzel, that's Glide. Okay, fine. So I want right. Thank God there are illiterate people in the world, right?
Yeah.
Well, people like me that I can't text. It's just like drives me crazy. I mean, two words, that's why max, you know. Alright. So comes along Rav Kook, and this is on page 3, in this mind-boggling tshuva, really land-breaking tshuva. And guess what? He says that there is such a thing as Malchus in our time. And that the Shoftim indeed did have a status of Malach. How does he reconcile this with the Rambam's prerequisite of having Sanhedrin, Alpi Navi? So we'll read the relevant words in Rav Kook, and if you'll allow me, with a little poetic license, I'm going to translate what he says into my Lumdisha jargon. He says the following. He says, does anybody want to read this just to do me that favor? You see the part that's underlined. You see what's on the line? Okay, so stop for a split second. He's saying in a mind boggling chiddush, he's saying that the power to appoint a melech invested in Sanhedrin is not really Sanhedrin.
The representatives.
Exactly. Sanhedrin are the representatives of the tzibur of Klali, so of the Uma Klalit. So again, it's not a din in Sanhedrin per se, but rather it's a din in the Uma, in the whole nation. And who represents the nation? Sanhedrin. But let's say there's no Sanhedrin. Then the power reverts back to the Uma HaKlos. And now we have to decide who's going to represent the Ummah, the nation as a whole, in order to make these decisions. All right, Max, you want to finish it up? How would you translate the English word ubiichud? And especially, correct? That's how you say it, right? Ubiichud. So Rav Osai here comes along with Rav Kook and he says the following, that no doubt that the Shofet is not a Melech, because he can't appoint a Melech without Shimim's Kamim, etc., etc. But on the other hand, he has Mishpatei HaMelucha, he has certain powers that are monarchical powers that belong to a king, and he can effectuate that whenever it's nogea to the entire klal. Decisions that could have repercussions to the entire nation can be made by the Shofet through the operation of Mishpatei HaMelucha, because again, the real source of authority and power is in the people, and now the Shofet becomes the representative of the people to implement those powers for the sake of the klal. And again, we can use the terminology of Tikkun Olam. I just want to take a little bit of poetic license and translate Rav Kook into my jargon, because you know this, the language is a little bit foreign to me. I mean, but this is easy compared to the rest of Rav Kook's writings. You know, I can't even, you know, I don't even understand Rav Kook in translation. That's the truth. Even in English, I can't understand Rav Kook. But when he discusses halach, it's a little more tangible. I think what he's saying is, in Yiddish, we say it's a briska terminology came from Rav Chaim Briska. Tzvei dinim. There are two dimensions to Melech. Melech, on the one hand, is a minui gavra, means he himself is appointed through the halacha, you know, the mechanism of halacha, as a Melech. He now, as a gavra, his status is that of a Melech. There is another din, and that is Mishpatei HaMelucha. Now, Mishpatei HaMelucha, to some extent, is an overlap between the Melech as a Gavra and the people of Israel who are represented by the Melech. Rav Kook's chiddush is that you can separate between the two dimensions. That it's not an inseparable package deal. It doesn't mean that unless you're a chal shem melech begavro with a minui and al tzdink, you don't have mishpatei hamelucha. Mishpatei hamelucha, whenever necessary, could exist and can be implemented and effectuated even without a gavra who is appointed as a melech. So we take that back now to the situation of terrorism. We might be able to suggest, according to Rav Kook, again, I'm just throwing it out as a logical possibility, that we might be able to send in Jews who are outside the Suffolk, put their lives into danger to save the hostages, even if we don't accept the Kesef Mishnah, even if we don't take the Chavos Yoreh's Raya as a proof, even if we rely on the bulk of poskim that have been codified or collected by Rav Avadi Yosef in 39 pages, if he fills you with his style, and he goes through everyone who says that I don't have to put my life in the danger for your life. That's not one of the big three. It's a great mitzvah tzolah, but nevertheless, it could be that the government of Israel has the status of a shofet with mishpatei hamelucha. They can make a tikkun olam and decide for the benefit of the entire country that we need to go in there and attack these terrorists. But if you look at the title of this handout, you'll see that there's a whole other dimension to this issue. Because the premise that we've been working with here is that we're going to send in soldiers in order to free the hostages. But there's a whole other option, obviously. What's the whole other option? We could possibly negotiate with the terrorists, and maybe we'll free terrorists from jails, from prisons, in order to save the hostages without having to expose our lives to danger. The question is that a naive assumption in the political reality of our times? So take, for example, the case of Gilad Shalit. We freed 1,000 terrorists. Some of them had Jewish blood on their hands. They were shofei damim. And there's no question that even today, and the Israelis are living through this now. I mean, I'm talking about the Shabak and then all the Kochot HaBitachon, that some of those terrorists that we freed in the deal with Gilad Shalit are out there to murder more people. So if, let's say, I would assume the facts on the ground are the following, that if I negotiate with the terrorists on the one hand, if I successfully complete that process of negotiation, I could free the hostages without exposing anyone to danger. But the flip side of that is it really so that I'm not exposing them to danger? Right? No, those soldiers who would go in there maybe are not exposed to danger. We're going to make the barter exchange. But on the other hand, we're exposing to danger innocent men, women, and children who are going to become the target of attacks of those Palestinian terrorists who have been freed from jail. And therefore, I think in this situation, if we apply the following two premises. Premise number one is, yes, I'm going to accept Rav Kook. I'm going to say that the state of Israel has mishpatei hamelucha. They have the right, if they so choose, to send Israeli soldiers in, put their lives on the line in order to save hostages. Yes. But then I'm going to accept the second premise. And that is that if I negotiate with the terrorists, basically I'm in a situation where I've saved myself the exposure to danger of those chayalim who would go in this pu'ulat tzva'it in order to save them, but at the same time, balancing it almost like a seesaw, I've exposed to danger all the innocent men, women, and children who will now be the target of an attack of the Palestinians. So what would come out here in this seesaw is that I think the decision would have to be made, what's the best thing to do? In other words, how do we, in a sense, cut our losses? How do we minimize the damage? Are we saying that let's deal with the immediate danger that these hostages are exposed to, and that's what we have now? Or should we look in the broader sense of what does this mean to down the line when these Palestinians who are freed from jails are coming back to haunt us? On top of that, within the context of Mishpatei Hamelucha and Tikkun Olam, the government no doubt has to make another shikul hadat. They have to consider and weigh the moral fiber of the entire country. So, for example, the early history of the state of Israel, if you turn back the clock, you mentioned Malot, there was no negotiating with terrorists. Any negotiation with terrorists was just to stall for time. It was a fig leaf. But that's changed. And if you need any proof for it, it's Gilad Shalit. I mean, now the entire people of Israel and the government reflecting that have changed the entire approach. It's no longer that, you know, we're the tough guys, we don't negotiate with terrorists, we're going to track you down and we're going to destroy you. It's a different kind of hashkafa today. And some might say, as we touched on before, that maybe the terrorists are part of a government almost, that we've softened our entire stand on terrorists. And that really has moral implications way down the line. What I want to show you here on this page, page one, is that there is a possibility of committing murder, and I choose my words deliberately, for the sake of Hatzol. Let me give you an example. This case came up, and it was actually asked in front of the Chazon Ish some 50 years ago. There's a bunker, and a hand grenade is thrown into a bunker. You have five Israeli soldiers on this side, and you have three Israeli soldiers on the other side, and one of the five is deflecting the hand grenade away from his group on this side of the bunker where the hand grenade is about to hit, and three soldiers will be immediately killed. Now, when you throw a hand grenade and three soldiers immediately killed, what's that called in halachic terms? You don't have to be a super genius.
Ritzicha.
That's an act of ritzicha, correct? Is there any way under the sun that we could be matir ritzicha? The Gemara says in Sanhedrin, which is the first source on your page one, that there are three averes for which we never allow those averes, even if it means that life will be forfeited. And that one of those three is ritzicha. So there doesn't seem to be any heter for ritzicha at all. And yet, paradoxically, when the Gemara in Sanhedrin asks the question, Minayin, how do you know that you can't kill someone in order to save life? And the Gemara comes up with a svara. Do you remember this world-class famous svara? Mi yemer d'damot d'dav su fe, who says that your blood is redder than his? So if somebody puts a gun to you and it says, kill him, or I'll kill you, you have to let yourself be killed. But if not for the svara, if not for the miyemar, if we were operating within the framework of scripture, of the psukim in the Torah, we would have come to the conclusion that the Torah says, v'chai bohem, v'lo shiyomus bohem. And therefore, I am allowed to violate any aver in the Torah in order to save life, unless I know otherwise. So Reb Chaim Brisker wanted to say that maybe the svar of miyemar is what we call a gili milsa. Gili milsa means it reveals something to us. And what it's teaching us is that there's no heter, no permissibility to violate ritzicha under any circumstances whatsoever. And I want to call to your attention a case which is addressed here on the bottom of your page, quoted by the Kesef Mishnah, the name of Moshe Cohen, where we could give up one Jew who's going to be killed for the sake of the many. And Rav Moshe Cohen thinks that in this case we don't have the svar of miyemer. You know, here we could clearly postulate that one group of red blood cells are greater than the other, meaning to save the many is certainly more significant than the few. And guess what the Chazon Ish paskins in the case of the hand grenade? You're allowed to do it. Could you imagine this? The Chazon Ish is matir deflecting the hand grenade even though three soldiers will die immediately. Isn't this a case of Ritzicha? But if we place the Chazon Ish's psak within the context of Moshe Cohen who lived 6 centuries ago, way before the Chazon Ish, then what's going on here is, yes, we're allowed to permit Ritzicha. Even murder is to be permitted. The problem is we're stuck up against a very hard wall, and that is miyemar. How do you make this shikul? And the answer is, says Rav Moshe Cohen, that we can make that shikul, we can apply that svara, and in certain situations we have a definite answer to the question of miyemar. For example, you have the case of saving the mother by destroying the embryo. If the embryo and it's the birth process is endangering life of the mother, the Jewish way of looking at it, as opposed to other religions, is that we destroy the embryo in order to save the mother. And why is that so? Reb Chaim was of the opinion that destroying the life of an embryo is ritzicha. It's murder. Again, it depends what stage of development the embryo is in, but past a certain stage when the embryo can live as a viable being, that's called Ritzicha. How are we allowing to be Docha Nefesh Mipnei Nefesh? And Reb Chaim has a whole thesis on this. But once again, what we're saying is that there are situations in which the halacha might condone an act of murder for the sake of preventing a worse tragedy. Now, I don't know if you know about the case of U.S. Airways back in at the time of September 11th. You know, there was a plane, and it actually, according to the historians, the U.S. National Guard, the Air Guard, you know, of the Air Force, was actually about to intercept that plane because they believed that that plane was going to hit, you know, Washington, D.C. and wreak complete havoc. Now, in doing so, the decision was being made, again, if you take a look at it for a second in halachic terms, of violating Ritzicha, of killing all the innocent people on that plane in order to prevent a greater damage, a greater catastrophe. And you and I would have said, wait a minute, there's nothing that could allow Ritzicha. Nothing could permit Ritzicha. It's an immovable mover. It's like, what shall I say, Avodah Zarah. You know, even if you have to die, you don't violate Avodah Zarah. But yet, within the context of this Rav Moshe Kona, you take a look, I bolded it on the bottom of your page, he says, Hachaleka hai svara, this is about three lines up from the bottom, here there is no svara of miyemar, do yeargu kulam, vehu atzmo mutav sheharek. He says that the person himself who could save everyone else should actually commit suicide, even though suicide constitutes ritzicha, in order to save the many. I found also in the Me'iri and Sanhedrin, he also says that we can sacrifice the Yachid for the sake of the Rabbin. Comes all the Kesefish, he says, no. You can only do that if the Yachid that you want to sacrifice, it has been designated. That's called Yichud. So the Goyim say, give me so-and-so, or else I'll kill you. In that case, you can give up so-and-so. But to go ahead and choose someone at random and decide that he will be the scapegoat, the kapara hindle, you know, to save the rest, that we can't do. In other words, the Kesef Mishnah fundamentally agrees with Rav Moshe Cohen that the principle is we could override Ritzicha for the sake of the greater good, but we cannot, it's like immoral to make the decision who it is, because the Kesef Mishnah's logic is as follows. He says, when you're going to choose someone, then he has a right to say, mi yemar. Right, take a look at the last line in the Kesef Mishnah going on to the second page. He says, because if you choose Reuven, Reuven says, wait a minute, you're telling me that my blood is less red than anyone else's blood, and then you're going to choose Shimon, and the same thing. So you can never decide who should be forfeited, who should be sacrificed, even for the many, and therefore the Svara of Mi Yemar will always apply. So this is a case in which we have a very, very difficult issue of deciding whether how to do miyemar. I just want to point out that within the context of this discussion, we should mention the Mishnah in Gittin, which is the next to the last source on page 2. The Mishnah in Gittin says, "Ein podim es hashvuyim yeser al kidei demeihem mipnei tikkun olam." That when non-Jews, let's say, capture a Jew, and they'll ask for a ransom of who knows what, you know, let's say billions of dollars. So the halach is mishum tikkun olam, that we should not negotiate with them. Imagine, we know someone is going to die. Money is not worth as much as a life. Why would we balk? Why would we be restricted and not give all the money that they're demanding?
You know, it's a bigger picture, that it'll encourage you for next time.
Exactly. Because it's going to encourage them to come next time. And I'm wondering, in the discussion that we're having today about how we should go, you know, let's say we're allowed to send in soldiers based on either the mitzvah milchama, based on the Kesef Mishnah, based on the fact that we think that the pula will be successful. Baruch Hashem, in the case of Entebbe, we had a great miracle. And the alternative is to negotiate. And in the context of these negotiations, we're going to, number one, expose other Jews to danger. And it's almost definite. And number two, it's going to wreck perhaps the moral fiber of the Israeli society, because now we're just basically, you know, bowing our heads to the terrorists. And I'm wondering if, in addition to that, we have a violation of the rule of the Mishnah Gittin, not in terms of the amount of money, but in terms of the fact that this encourages the terrorists to take more and more of our terrorists.
Yeah.
But I want you to know, friends, that if you know, if you buy into this thesis, or if I buy into my own thesis, I mean, that has, you know, really serious and somber repercussions for our current situation. So that what we're going to say is that we don't negotiate with terrorists. But that's only because we have another option. And as difficult and as painful that option is of sending soldiers and exposing to danger, but I think if we accept that within the context of either Tikkun Olam, taking the Mishpachon of Rav Kook, or the context of Mitzvah Melchama against terrorists, the way Rav Avad Yosef said it, and in the overall picture of the moral fiber of our society, I believe, and I don't know if anyone here agrees with me, maybe you all think I'm crazy, I don't know. Yeah, you know, you haven't been throwing any rotten tomatoes at me yet, because maybe they're not around here, that's all. But I believe that we should be going in there and just, you know, blowing them to smithereens. Again, the problem is that, you know, when they have, and as in the case of Nachshon Waksman, Zichrono Livracha, you know, they have you hostage. So, you know, you don't really have it. Even though one would have possibly argued that in Entebbe it didn't, but in Entebbe, you know, the experts thought that there was a chance. You remember that the airport of Entebbe was built by the Israelis. You know, they had the plans, so they were able to pull this off. I mean, the whole story is like from reading a suspense novel. It's from the fairy tales, but they pulled it off. It's a lot more, you know. Again, sometimes we have the advantage of, you know, making believe, showing the terrorists as if we're negotiating with them, and then we catch them by surprise, and all of a sudden we storm the building. But it's a very highly problematic situation. So, at the end of the day, you know, there are basically two roads here, two approaches to take. You know, we can expose ourselves to danger in order to save the hostages. We can negotiate with the terrorists and expose ourselves to danger in a different way. And maybe the danger of exposing ourselves to freed terrorists is even greater. I don't know. You know, some cynics say, free them all. What's the difference? I mean, they multiply like, you know, what is that lizard or something that you cut them in half and you get two of them? You know what I'm saying? So, like for example, now the Israelis are rounding up terrorists. You know what I'm saying? Are you up on the news? I don't know how many they took. I think...
350.
How many?
350.
350. So, in my mind, you know what's good about that? What's good about that is that we have more cards in our deck to negotiate. You know what I'm saying? We might as well get a couple thousand of them so that we have more of a negotiating position. I don't know. But again, the whole issue of negotiating with terrorists is a very, very sticky issue. I don't think it's so much an issue.
If you're only releasing terrorists that you only capture after they captured them. So at the end of the day, they're back to zero.
Right. And maybe they're even stronger than zero because they realize that, you know, it's such a mud mazak. It's such a strange situation. I don't know how to describe it. Where, you know, the terrorists are the national heroes of the entire Palestinian nation. You know, it used to be maybe Hamas and it wasn't Fatah, but now it's everybody. It's like they're all Hainu Hach in this case. So the Palestinians on the streets are celebrating that we got the three boys, and they'll continue celebrating, and with such a strong moral backing, as if the terrorists are the heroes of the Palestinian people. Why not? And forget about all the promises that they have, you know, for after Lachem Avies, you know, they get blown up by the Israelis, they, whatever, I don't want to go into detail here, mixed company, but, you know, it's just an amazing kind of situation. What are we supposed to do here? I think we need an Ur V'tumim to get us an answer to this case.
What was this for the Chazon Ish in the bunker?
Oh, beautiful. So with this, we'll call it a day. The Chazon Ish says the following. Unbelievable. His question is, in the case of Rabbi Akiva, two people are in a desert. One has the water and the other doesn't. Reuven is holding on to the Kiton Shomayim. When Reuven drinks that water, he is causing the death of Shimon. And the Gemara uses a special pasuk to substantiate Rabbi Akiva's principle of Chayecha Kodmin, V'chei Achicha Imach. Without that pasuk, V'chei Achicha Imach, even Rabbi Akiva apparently would agree that you can't drink that water. The water might be yours in Choshev Mishpat terms. Legally, you know, maybe it's worth something on the market, but above and beyond that, it's human life. And when you drink that water, you are basically inadvertently killing someone. The Rambam, by the way, seems to believe in many, if you take a look on page 2, in many different Piskei Dinim here in the Rambam, that if someone causes the death of someone else, he's a rotzeach. For example, the Rambam has a case in Halacha Beis where he hires people to have someone killed, where he sends his servants. He has a case in Halacha Beis where he ties up his friend in a way that he can't get free, and the lions, the animals, beasts come along and kill him, or the sun comes out and beats on him and kills him. And the Rambam says in all these cases, Chayav Misa L'Shamayim, and it's Beis Din can't put him to death, because technically he didn't violate the full-fledged Maaser Tzicha, but he's a Rotzeach, the Rambam says. Even the Rambam in the case of suicide says he should be put to death for suicide, just that he's already dead. So we have cases where the definition of Ritzicha is a very broad one. So the Chazon Ish, getting back to the case of the water, he says the following. The basic difference here, and what do we derive from V'cheyachicha Imach that allows Reuven to drink his water, is that we view Reuven's drinking of the water as an act of Hatzolah rather than as an act of Ritzicha. In other words, the Chazon Ish postulates that there are fundamentally two different categories or classifications of actions that are rachok, that are far away one from the other, like mizrach and marav. There's an act of hatzolah, and there's an act of ritzicha. Sometimes the distinction between the two is blurred. So for example, if I drink the water to save myself, is that an act of hatzolah, or is that an act of ritzicha, knowing full well that you're going to perish as a result of the fact that you don't have the water to drink? In the case of the hand grenade, how do we view the chayal, who's one of the five, if you remember, deflecting the hand grenade? So you can define it in one of two ways. You can see it as an act of ritzicha, or you can see it as an act of hatzolah. And there's a phenomenal difference between the two. If you view it as an act of ritzicha, then it's prohibited. Even, he says, for the sake of the five. Because we're going to still apply the principle of the Gemara in the Sefer Sanhedrin, and we're going to say, again, according to this, okay, even though I told you the Meirian, you know, he has a different approach, but we're not going to play the numbers game. We're going to say Ritzicha, and someone's going to die. Oh, no. We're not allowing Ritzicha, even for the sake of Hatzolah, and even for that soul of the masses. Yamusu kula v'ayimsu lev nefesh achas piso. But if I could redefine the action as an act of Hatzolah, just as a result of the Hatzolah, there's Ritzicha, that's permissible. And that's Rabbi Akiva V'Cheyachicha Imo. Says the Chazon Ish, I would define the act of deflecting the hand grenade as an act of Hatzolah, not as an act of Ritzicha, even though knowing full well that as a result of this Hatzolah, the three Chayalim on this side of the bunker are going to die. Do you buy into that? I'm just curious, what's your intuition here? I mean, we're not here to argue against the Chazon Ish, you know. We're not great scholars on the level of the Chazon Ish.
It's hard.
What?
For me, it's hard.
For me, it's also very hard.
When you drink water, it's not like you take a hand grenade and throw it at someone. I mean, it's...
Well, wait a minute. I just want to point out one thing. The tshuva is not 100% clear, but I think if you read it carefully, I don't have a few in front of you on the Makoros page, but I think he's talking about a case of deflecting a hand grenade.
Right. Yeah.
I get, you know, it sounds like I'm splitting hairs over here, but halacha works in a very strict operation. Deflecting means that the hand grenade is going here, and I'm pushing it back, you know, so to speak. But there's only one place for it to go and to land. If I were to catch the hand grenade, seriously, it's not a joke. It could be that this is not far from its youth. It could be. I could catch the hand grenade and then throw it. But the only place I could throw it is a place where Jews will perish, that even the Chazon Ish would say that's an act of ritzicha. But do you realize, my friends, how dakus, you know, how meticulous and subtle we have to be to define the difference between an act of hatzol and an act of ritzicha? How in many situations and scenarios they overlap to such an extent that it's totally ambiguous, and it's the twilight zone to try to define, is this an act of Atzol, is an act of Ritzicha?
How about taking your own life?
Taking your own life is Ritzicha. But why would it be Atzol? I missed you on that.
Jumping on the grenade.
Jumping.
Oh, jumping on the grenade.
You're going to save the rest.
Okay, jumping on the grenade. Is that called an act of Hatzalah? No, that's an excellent question. Wait a minute. Can I get right back to Jonathan? I don't want to keep you over because we got... But what is jumping on a grenade? Would that be an act of self, of suicide, of Ritzicha, or is it an act of Hatzalah? I'm sure the Chazon Ish would call it an act of Hatzalah.
Well, it's parallel to the same case if the Gentiles say, send one person out of the town or we'll kill all of you. Right.
Well, one person can volunteer. But Jonathan, I was going to ask add one thing. Why is that called an act of Ritzicha? Because I know full well what the guy we're going to do with him. But on the other hand, why not view that as an act of Hatzalah? Do you see again where it becomes a little bit ambiguous?
No, but there you have to choose.
Okay,
the set is undefined. It's not if it's objectively defined. Who has to die according to the circumstances? It's not Ritzicha.
Correct. But I'm asking if you have to choose, and that act of Bechira, of Mesira, is done for the sake of Hatzalah, it's at least in my mind, Jonathan, it's a free country, you can disagree. I don't find it very comfortable to define that as an act of Ritzicha. I would argue that sending someone to die for the sake of saving everyone else is no less of a Hatzalah act than deflecting a hand. Okay, thanks everyone for coming again, and have a great week, and we should hear Bsarot Tovot, and none of this should be halacha lamaisa, you know.
If it's one person on one side of the line and five on the other side, is that also my side solo? Because it's having yourself?
No.
That's not?
The Chazon Ish is only going to allow it in two conditions after you fill. Number one, you're saving the majority, and forfeiting the minority.
That's only the Ramach.
No, I'm saying the Chazon Ish builds on the Ramach. Notice he's saying that you can only you have to circumvent me Yemar. You can't save yourself and have everyone die.
Right.
You know, and number two, it has to be an act of Hatzolah rather than an act of Ritzicha.
But that's how he circumvents me Yemar, because he's saying it's not a Meiser Ritzicha. Me Yemar is once you're done with a Meiser Ritzicha, then you have me Yemar problems.
Right.
But if you can define the act as an act of Hatzolah, not of Ritzicha.
But still, he assumes that even within the context of Hatzolah, there's only a het of Hatzolah as long as
because you're causing Ritzicha.
Right. There's an element of causing Ritzicha.
Ah, so you can't define the act as a Maisa Hatzolah if
more people will perish.
If it's more,
then
so even three and five is the same problem. It needs to be
correct.
Or if the five,
right, and that's why the Chazon Ish specifically addresses that scenario where you have the three and the or the five and the three, meaning the one of the five is saving the majority.
Got it.
Then I can define it as Hatzalah. So the numbers here are very relevant in order to define it as a Maisa Hatzalah.
So he's still using the Ramach, basically.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. All right, Adam. Have a great week.
Sure,
good. Thank you so much. I shouldn't call you Adam. I think people call you Osher. But I'll get used to it. It takes a while. The Gemara says in Babasa, Shabesh the whole the al. Because once you get a mistake in the end, it's hard to get it.